Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast where we discuss classic works of management and organization studies. Welcome to episode 59, where we are discussing Douglas McGregor's classic book, The Human Side of Enterprise, originally published in 1960. To get the text and for more information, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. This is part one of the episode, which we've subtitled Examining McGregor's Theory X and Theory Y. This is Tom, calling in from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States.
This is Ralph, coming to you from the eastern side of the Rocky Mountains in the great state of Montana, United States.
This is Catherine, coming to you from the Midlands of England in Royal Leamington Spa.
Welcome, everybody, and especially welcome Catherine, our newest podcaster.
Yeah, it's great to have you, Catherine.
Thank you.
Yeah, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, Catherine?
Well, my name is Catherine Jackson. I graduated from Warwick Business School in England this year. The first lecture I had on the first day of my course was organizational behavior, and I immediately fell in love with the subject. And my dissertation for my MBA was entitled Tech Culture and Performance. It was a case study of a deliberately developmental organization, which I was fascinated by. And on that journey, doing my dissertation, I encountered Kunda's engineering culture, which had a major influence on me, and came across the podcast and was immediately hooked. And it played a big part in my enjoyment of my learning. And I'm absolutely delighted to be here and joining the conversation.
Well, thank you very much. And welcome to Talking About Organizations.
Welcome, Catherine. It's great to have you.
Thank you.
Okay. That dovetails right nicely into today's reading, which is Douglas McGregor's The Human Side of Enterprise from 1960. Ralph, can you give us a quick overview of the text?
Douglas McGregor can be considered one of the forefathers of modern management theory. He transformed approaches to human resources thinking by transforming his personal observations in industrial work settings into two ways managers could view employees. Theory X assumes workers depend exclusively on external motivation and won't work unless they are compelled to do so. Theory Y, on the other hand, assumes that workers are self-motivated and seek to maximize their personal goals through work. Theory X assumptions lead to an authoritarian style of management, where the emphasis is on productivity, on the concept of a fair day's work, on the evils of feather bedding and restriction of output, what Taylor called soldiering, and on rewards for performance. Theory X reflects an underlying belief that management must counteract an inherent human tendency to avoid work. Theory X is the style that predominated in business after the mechanistic system of scientific management, whose leading proponent was Frederick Taylor, had swept everything before it in its first few decades of the 20th century. On the other hand, Theory Y assumptions generate a participative style of management that assumes that people will exercise self-direction and self-control in the achievement of organizational objectives to the degree to which they are committed to those objectives. It is management's main task in such a system to maximize that employee commitment. Both Theory X and Theory Y are ideal forms of management, and McGregor acknowledged that real work conditions require a balance of these theories. In the book, McGregor seems to lean towards the idea that management's chief responsibility is not control of behavior per se, but rather setting the workplace conditions that will enable people to channel their personal motivations and emotional needs towards the achievement of both their own and the company's economic objectives. Viewing employees not as cogs in a machine, but as living beings with individual goals, this is what McGregor called the human side of the enterprise, has given companies that do it well a remarkable competitive advantage. Technological and societal changes, such as the rise of knowledge work and computerization of work, have supported the trend of making companies become more humane. And these are trends that, if McGregor didn't exactly foresee them, he certainly anticipated work going in that direction. Now, the text deals with policies and practices in the management of human resources in business and industrial organizations, examining them in the light of current social science, and knowledge about human nature and behavior at the time McGregor wrote it. Two important suppositions form the basis of his material. McGregor argued that the assumptions underlying Theory X, upon which traditional organizations were based, were inadequate for the full utilization of human capability. Theory Y's assumptions were consistent with then-current sociological and a lot of recent research and knowledge. The implications of Theory Y in regard to the administration of salaries and promotions, performance appraisal, staff-line relationships, participation, leadership, management development, and the managerial team are discussed in great deal in chapters 5 to 12. The book is organized into 16 chapters, and I think of them as forming four parts. Chapters 1 and 2 are really about the scientific basis for the theories of management and the assumptions that underlie them and the importance of conforming to accepted knowledge or scientific knowledge. Chapters 3 and 4 are where McGregor goes into the details of Theory X and Y and the assumptions on which they are based and the implications to which they lead. The heart of the book really is chapters 5 to 12, and I would include chapter 16 in that, where McGregor lays out how these assumptions and practices based on Theory Y actually work in work settings. He gives many case studies and examples from his practice. Chapters 13 to 15 are really about leadership and leadership skills and developing them, and are interesting, but I think the core of the book is in chapters 5 to 12, and I include chapter 16 in there because it's at the end of the book, but it talks about how the managerial team should relate to each other under Theory Y assumptions, and I think it really fits well with that middle part of the book.
Okay, thanks for that, Ralph, and I want to add, in terms of the impact of McGregor's ideas, the version of the book that I read was the annotated version, which was 2006. And in it, the original 16 chapters have been appended with a series of call-out boxes and footnotes, additional footnotes, showing the various ways in which Theory Y has influenced current management scholarship. So we're talking about what had happened in the 46 some odd years after the original book was published. And it's just astounding to me, reading through the annotations, just how wide the wide appeal that Theory Y and its implications, its suggested practices has across all sectors of organizations. It's had a lasting impact.
Right, and I would encourage our listeners, if you don't own the book, the annotated version is readily available on Amazon and other sources. That's actually a really good version to use.
Okay, so we kind of want to do, why don't we start with the part one and just sort of discuss a little bit about what he's laid down as the foundation for what he would come to as Theory X and Theory Y, because I mean, he talks about scientific knowledge and some of the assumptions that led into the managerial theories that came up to, leading up to 1960.
One of the things that struck me about the managerial theories and the basis in science that comes up in the first chapter is he really starts out with the essence of management, and that is prediction and control of human behavior. And that took me a little bit by surprise, because as a sociologist, organizational theory scientist, I don't really look at it as control of people, because I don't think that's really possible. And that really goes to the heart of what Tom was saying earlier, that we've really advanced a long way since Frederick Taylor's time, and control isn't really the first thing that we think about. But it is. I think it is important that he establishes that baseline, and his conception that the social sciences are a rich resource for management today. The one thing that made me a little uncomfortable in those first two chapters, where he starts talking about social science and physics, and I'm not so sure physics is a good analogy for social science, because there's a lot more variables involved, and humans are a lot less predictable than dropping rocks off the Tower of Pisa or cannonballs, those kinds of things. But I think it's his emphasis on gathering knowledge through research and then basing your understandings about people and organizations and how they function on the best research knowledge that we have to date. And I thought that was an important way for him to lay the groundwork for what comes later.
what appealed to me in chapter two in particular really was just how of its time, the time context of him addressing how complex the role of a manager is, which was, I guess, later addressed by many people like Mintzberg and others. But the it really is apparent how complex the role is and how it shifts according to who you speak to. And as a practitioner as well, as somebody who researches and is interested in this subject anyway, I think that's extremely relevant today as it ever was.
Yeah, and it's interesting that the charge that he levies in the middle of the chapter, where he says that the conventional principles that, you know, came from scientific management and that had come before his time were derived, derived primarily from the study of models, and he specifies the military and the Catholic Church, which are two very, very centrally hierarchical types of organizations, which differ in important respects from modern industrial organizations. So, you know, in a lot of ways, you can kind of see where he's coming from in terms of what he's viewing as the control mechanism that he's sort of repudiating when he starts comparing theory X and theory Y and the rest of the part.
Well, and the other thing I thought was interesting about using those two organizations is, to some extent, theory X is a caricature of organizations. And we've seen that in other readings where the authors will take an idealized and maybe far end of the spectrum view of, as Catherine was talking, the complexity of organizations and the difficulties people face. And they use these very strict archetypes to say, okay, well, here's the strong contrast. And I think that makes it better. I think it's better that theory X and theory Y are based on these strong contrasts and maybe models that perhaps weren't even applicable in the time of the book was written. However, they do help us see some of the key differences. And actually later in the book, McGregor, he starts blending a bit of the two and say, well, it's really about a balance. And here's some of the things you have to think about. I like that way of starting out, saying, well, we have this, you know, the Catholic Church and the military and all these outdated organizational theories. And then we have this more humanistic modern view, and then doing a little bit of a blending later, because I think that works well to help you look at each end and then move towards the middle. I did think it was good use of the concept natural law. I mean, this part where he was talking about physics and engineering, I thought was a really good illustration, where he talks about the essence of control is actually adapting to natural law. That's a really key insight. And so whether you strongly agree that humans observe, you know, human behavior observes laws or is strongly predictable, perhaps the trends are, and that's actually something that McGregor exceeds. And this idea that that engineers don't design mechanisms to make water flow uphill, you know, naturally, but we seem to in organizations design mechanisms that we expect the same kind of that functional equivalent for people of water flowing uphill is going to happen by ignoring human needs and motivations and behaviors and the integration aspect of the work. I thought that was actually a good model and a good analogy to use to illustrate how there are times in organizations where you just want to scratch your head and say, all right, you guys are doing this thing, and you think this is going to lead to what outcomes? You know, why do you think that exactly? And that's actually something he talks about in both the first two chapters, this idea of critically examining your assumptions. And, you know, your assumptions may be good, but you really need to get them out in the open and talk about them so that you understand how they're influencing the management practices you have. And I thought that was a brilliant insight, this idea that if you don't examine the assumptions on which your actions are based, it's going to lead to ineffective outcomes because you really have no idea what the connection is between your theory and that you have underlying your assumptions, or the theory that connects your assumptions to the actual practice you put in place.
I had shades of a previous episode we did on Kurt Lewin, who also tried to use the physical sciences as a metaphor to sort of compare you know, the physical sciences, or something about the physical sciences and applying to a social phenomenon. Lewin's case with force field analysis was seemed to make sense from the perspective of how, you know, interrelationships work. This one, in terms of the explaining why organizations perhaps don't build their processes and systems in line with human behavior, was also, I thought, equally powerful and kind of amusing.
In 1960, quite revolutionary to even address it, I would imagine. Hence the title, The Human Side of Enterprise, in a way that perhaps, you know, the human element wasn't addressed previously.
Oh, that's definitely the case. I mean, he talks quite a bit about some of the work that was going on around the same time, but he definitely is putting his foot out and saying that, hey, this is we're doing things wrong. It's very clear that Theory X isn't working well, and we need to try to change our thinking into a different paradigm, which might be good at this point to actually examine what he really means by Theory X and Theory Y.
Well, he lays out the assumptions that he believes underpin Theory X in Chapter 3, and the title says it all, the traditional view of direction and control. And three main assumptions, and there's actually more, but he introduced them throughout the book, but the three main assumptions are that the average human being has an inherent dislike of work and will avoid it if he can, that he must be compelled to work. And it's really interesting how you see that creeping into modern work practices and managerial theories. I mean, it's not like that's completely been banished, but it was very strong perhaps in the 1960s. And then as a consequence of this inherent dislike people have to work, that they have to be coerced, controlled, directed, or threatened with punishment. So there's this whole carrot and stick approach to get people to put forth the effort necessary to achieve organizational objectives. And the third one is that the average human being actually prefers to be directed, wants to avoid responsibility, and really doesn't have any ambition, and that their primary motivation is security, a protected job or security for their family or something like that. And McGregor sums this all up with the term, this view is based on the concept of mediocrity of the masses, which I thought was kind of funny. And sometimes, you know, perhaps in sporting events and football stadiums and those kind of things, some of that goes on, but I, you know, at work, maybe not so much. And, you know, Lewin acknowledges that Theory X is not a straw man for, you know, that he sets up for demolition. He actually sets it up so he can examine, okay, what are these assumptions? What are the implications, and how does this relate to the direction he saw work going in the 1960s? And I would say in some really important ways, McGregor was a visionary of the ways that he anticipated work going based on what he saw in the 1960s. And I think that's one of the most important aspects of the book.
Yeah, the description of those three assumptions, they would be interesting enough on their own, but he follows it with a theory of motivation, which I think, or some assumptions about motivation specifically, which I think are really worth exploring, because he gets into Maslow, which I thought was really interesting. You know, it's a key statement that he makes later in the chapter is that a satisfied need is not a motivator of behavior. If you are coming at this from a Theory X perspective, according to those three assumptions, then basically you're managing in order under the belief that if you satisfy a need, it will motivate behavior, to which McGregor obviously disagrees with very strongly, and explains that, you know, you can satisfy the physiological needs, say at the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy, but then, you know, that doesn't really actually give any true satisfaction to the human being as an individual. Or, you know, if he may no longer be fearful of being harmed physically or starving or what have you, but there's still so much more that, you know, the workplace doesn't necessarily provide in terms of satisfying needs. And so you know, if you stop at those three assumptions, then of course you're going to have people who may be satisfied physically, but they're wanting from an emotional or a spiritual sense.
I think that's a good point, because I think it is a bit of an extreme case to say, well, money doesn't, once people have an adequate amount of money or their physiological needs are met, then increases in pay or finances aren't motivating. That's not what I've seen. I think it's perhaps not as motivating, but I think perhaps in this assumption underestimates the capacity of people to want more things or want to be able to do more with money or have, you know, greater options. I mean, I think that's one of the aspects of modern life is we discover that, well, if people can work less, they also want more things they can do in their leisure time. And so there's been this huge rise in transportation and people traveling and getting currently stranded in other countries, like thousands of people from the UK are, because Thomas Cook went out of business. And so manufacturers and purveyors of consumer goods are really good at identifying more things for us to buy. And I'm not criticizing any of that. It's all great economics. But I think there remains a motivation for advancement, you know, personal advancement in pay and other kinds of aspects. So I don't know if that you can ever fully diminish that. And I think the key to understand from McGregor's perspective is it's not a primary motivator. You have other things motivating you. And I think what Tom said was really important on page 53, that McGregor goes on to say that unless there are opportunities at work to satisfy the higher level needs that Tom was talking about, people will be deprived and their behavior will reflect this deprivation and through various means and resistance and those kinds of things. And I think there's another statement in the book, and I forget exactly where it is, where McGregor says, you can't compel commitment. Coercion and force do not produce commitment. They can produce compliance, but in many work environments and the kinds of work that are done today, compliance actually isn't good enough to stay ahead of the competition or provide competitive advantage. You actually have to do more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he lists two areas or two types of needs that sort of get at that. And one of that is things that relate to one's self-esteem, which in some ways could be the provision of, you know, tangible objects or things, you know, things you might buy that. But what he really gets at is self-respect, self-confidence, for autonomy, for achievement. You can do that through, you know, acquiring stuff, or you could, you know, your self-esteem could be tied to basically pride in what you do, pride in the organizations you belong to, satisfaction of influence over the environment. And then the other category he lists was those that relate to one's reputation, which is the needs for status, for recognition, for appreciation. And obviously, you know, the physical, you know, the satisfaction of just the physical needs alone, again, going back to theory, the theory X assumptions, those don't in any way enhance one's reputation. You know, the things or the benefits provided through getting people to do things or to be compliant. You know, one wants to, according to McGregor, one wants to be able to establish themselves as somebody in the eyes of others. They look for status. So indeed, yeah, you see that conflict of what Theory X, you know, systems built on Theory X do not provide for the individual, which Theory Y, he argues, does. And so that's a whole different set of assumptions built in the following chapter. So let's take a look at those, because there are a total of six. And I'll just read them off real quick. One of them, the first one is, the expenditure of physical and mental effort in work is as natural as play or rest. That certainly repudiates the first assumption of Theory X. External control and the threat of punishment are not the only means for bringing about effort towards organizational objectives. Man will exercise self-direction and self-control in the service of objectives to which he is committed. That repudiates, yeah.
Right, and I think the key there is not the only means, right? So he's not saying you can't use them. He just says if that's the only tool in your toolbox, or if that's the only hammer you have, it's not going to work out for you well for you, because there's other objectives you can't meet that way.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I wholly agree. Third assumption is commitment to objectives is a function of the rewards associated with their achievement. Fourth, the average human being learns under proper conditions not only to accept but to seek responsibility. Then fifth is the capacity to exercise a relatively high degree of imagination, ingenuity, and creativity in the solution of organizational problems is widely, not narrowly, distributed in the population. That's definitely an opposite look from Theory X. And then finally, under the conditions of modern industrial life, the intellectual potentialities of the average human being are only partially utilized, which I would say is certainly the case, especially when you consider, you know, in industrial life, how much of one's time is actually in the workplace and how much other time, you know, is there available to people outside of the workplace to find more fulfilling things. I mean, there was definitely a lot of truth to that at the time that this was written.
Arguably, people have even less leisure time than they ever had, though. And that's probably another argument maybe for later on about the reality of how perhaps pervasive Theory X is today and how Theory Y, a lot of organizations actually masquerade as Theory Y, but at their root is Theory X. But that's perhaps an argument for later on.
Oh, that's a great observation, that they try to look like Theory Y, but when you look at actually what they put in practice, it's very Theory X. Yeah, I've seen that too.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think McGregor himself even caught a few cases of that, and certainly in the annotated version, some of that masking was uncovered in later research. That let's face it. I mean, Theory Y, even all things considered, certainly sounds a lot more attractive, inspiring than perhaps Theory X. I mean, if we're looking at where we would want to work, and we had and all choices being equal, you would want to have one who put forth the belief that or put forth presented themselves as being participative and being valuing of human life. When you find out the reality is very different once you actually get in there.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And also, I think, and I forget exactly where it's referenced in the book, but that certainly managers who aspire to leadership positions also realize that they need to be a Theory Y person to achieve that.
Right, that you have to rethink your assumptions. And I'm not sure about you two, but one of the things that bothered me a little bit when I'm reading about the assumptions of Theory Y was, okay, well, where's the science behind this? You're not even referring to research. You're not even trying to. And then later I reformed my thinking and I thought, well, it's based, as Tom said, on a very optimistic and high aspirational view of human nature and humans in general. And so whether it's true on average or not true on average that people want to seek more responsibility, what I think is really valuable about McGregor creating this archetype of the more humane workplace and these assumptions that underlie it is that it sets the foundation for the rest of the book where McGregor's able to say, if we designed an organization based on these assumptions, what would it look like? And how would people behave, or what would managers do differently? And we've seen many other works that we've examined where people will do that. They'll take some kind of ideal case and they'll acknowledge that, okay, it's not really this way, but we're going to look at it because we want to try to learn a little bit more about what this model tells us. And I think that was a really good insight. Instead of just saying, well, I have all this data and it means X, it's, well, what if it were like this? What would you do differently? And in many ways, it's very prescient because McGregor anticipates many of the developments of the work environment that we may take for granted unless we're organizational scholars and, you know, look into the details, but many aspects that I think people can take for granted and maybe not realize, hey, it wasn't always so. We've actually developed into these kinds of workplaces. And so that's why I think it's really, I'm willing to be less strict about, okay, where's the research in this part of these assumptions, and say, okay, but it really does set up the case studies he's going to do later.
Yeah, and it's, I'd say that with the annotated edition, you do see how much research has followed it and sort of reaffirmed the theory why. But I agree with you. It's initially on a first reading, you can forget that this was actually a rather pioneering idea, and that of course there's little beyond the author's own experiences in coming up with this. But even still, once we get to the meat of it, what you call the middle part from chapters 5 through 12, he actually, provides some pretty good explanations of what this looks like, both from a theory X and a theory Y perspective, across several different administrative functions, which, chapter 5 was management by integration and self-control. So it's sort of like an overview chapter of what it looks like a theory-Y management scheme would look like. And then he breaks it out into several different functions in later chapters, such as performance appraisal, salaries, promotions, all of those things that you can, if you're reading this from a practical mindset, you're wondering, all right, these theories sound interesting, and okay, you're putting me on the defensive because I'm a theory X person. What does your management system look like under these different assumptions that I'm not accustomed to? Well, here it is. This is what the rewarded system would look like. This is how you would do promotions, how you would appraise personnel, how you would manage the flow of work. And that's, I thought the middle section of the book was really, really helpful in trying to put the meat behind the theory. Otherwise, it just sounds like a bunch of, pretty PowerPoint bullets, if you know what I mean.
He's basically written before its time, before maybe the phrase was even developed, a mainstream classic, a blockbuster for every airport bookshop. And I think it's in Bennis's introduction as well, he said that McGregor, the reason why he was so successful and why it's stood the test of time, I guess, is the clarity in the book and also how he called it. So maybe some people were thinking about some of these theories at the time and he had the courage to say it where others didn't. And I think that's why, it does stand the test of time even today, even if we debate about along the margins of how things have developed even since. It really is a classic book.
Well, I think also you really hit the nail on the head there, Catherine, because the theory Y implication that is kind of a blockbuster for its time is that, look, if you're not getting the results that you want, it's not just the employees. I mean, there could be some aspect to that, and he acknowledges that. But he says on page 66, theory Y implies that the causes of poor performance or not meeting your objectives lie in management's methods of organization and control. He basically spins the trouble wheel 180 from the workers, where it's really easy to blame them because they're not motivated, they don't work hard, they don't care, those kinds of things, to say, no, that's management's job. And I would say that really is the dominant thinking in management and leadership scholarship today, and maybe in many organizations, that maybe it's not all management's fault, but it is largely management's responsibility to create this environment. And I think that was certainly a new idea and probably, like Catherine says, revolutionary for its time. Well, one thing I want to point out from this chapter on theory Y that feeds into the middle part of the book, as I discussed, is this concept of the principle of integration, because he really only addresses it here on page 68. And in the rest of the book, he just talks about it's not in accordance with the principles of integration. And he doesn't really explain it again. At least I didn't think it was very, very well explained. So I'm going to just emphasize it here for our listeners. He says, the central principle of organization in theory X is direction and control through the exercise of authority. And in theory Y, it's integration of member goals with success of the enterprise. Implications of the principle of integration are not easy to perceive. And I think, as Tom was saying, that's why he goes in that detail in the middle part of the book, because it's not obvious what all those implications are. And just as an aside, there's times you wonder why, as Catherine said, there's a lot of theory Y talking and theory X actions out in the workplace. Well, why isn't this actually more pervasive or more widespread in organizations. And it's possible, I don't want to do too much guessing, but there's a lot of work for management to go do here. And it's not like they have infinite amounts of time, or the workday isn't exceedingly complex. And so it's possible that people fall back on theory X because it's easier for people to just say, just go do this thing. And McGregor would caution that's a mistake.
I was going to offer that, if there was one segment of this middle part that really struck me, it was actually towards the end of it, which was chapters 11 and 12. And this had to do with the staff line relationships, because I felt that that was something that definitely carries on to the present day, where we talk about the relationships between, say, the staff function. And what we're talking about is, a line, McGregor's time would probably be like the assembly line itself, or the subordinate organizations that are performing the direct provision of services or the production of goods. And then the staff.
Right. The real work happens.
The real work happens. Exactly. And then the staff is this entity that basically provides the administration, the logistics, the human resources, all of those things that are necessary to enable the work of the line. Certainly, we've seen in some organizations, it is very tempting and sometimes all too tempting, where the staff functions predominate. So, for example, human resources becomes its own function. I mean, they should behave as a community of practice with all those within the whole organization that are performing or contributing to HR functions. But when the function itself becomes detached from and essentially acts superior over the line organizations, that's another form of control, which falls right in line with the Theory X assumptions that if the line organizations are not coerced into doing things a certain way from for HR purposes, they must be made to do so. Otherwise, the HR function will suffer. And that tension is can be very, very significant if the staff forgets its enabling function and sees itself as a you get the idea. I'm sorry, I'm running out of words.
I think you have a good point, Tom. And I've been in organizations where it felt like the line actually supported the staff at various times, which would drive me crazy. And HR can, in some organizations, be more of a gatekeeper as opposed to an enabler. And it's refreshing when you encounter a staff manager who doesn't see it that way, who believes it's their job to support and enable you. I do remember, though, in my early days in organizations, getting really frustrated with all these requirements and mandates that came down from some of the HR organizations until I realized a bit later in my career that a lot of what those mandates were self-protection for the organization as a whole, to keep line managers from creating lawsuits or grievances or those kinds of things, because a lot of times as a line person, you think, okay, I just got to get this stuff done and I can do all these things and your job is to support me. And then you get a little bit more experience and you say, oh gosh, here's some of these problems that occur if I don't follow these directions, or you get these employee problems, and you can see a little bit bigger picture. And I think to the extent that the staff teaches and coaches you on those things, as opposed to just insisting on the rules and beating you over the head with a book, is really where they can enhance their value.
Yeah. And getting to the lawsuit piece, I mean, we can certainly throw darts at the staffs for becoming their own little empires, if we want to be pejorative about it. But sometimes it's external factors that drive it. I mean, there's mandates coming from outside of the organization that requires some sort of a compliance, some sort of a, satisfaction of new laws, new regulations set at, say, a federal government level. Well, okay, I can see where the natural reaction would be, okay, you don't want to burden the line with that sort of stuff. The staff should be able to relieve the line of the need for doing things. The line gets told what to do in order to stay in compliance. But then it's when the reporting mechanism really does become the purpose of the purpose of life, and that's when it really starts to interfere, impinge on what the line manager is trying to do, just to be able to do the basic core function of the organization. if the staff doesn't,
they'll make them do it over, or they can't get their work done. And so I've seen both extremes, right, where the line people are ignoring the staff and blunder into grievance and lawsuit territory as a result. And then I've seen other extremes where this would just drove me nuts, where the staff people, they would have an argument themselves about the requirement. And then you would just be at this impasse, and it took impetus. That's a nice way to say it. Impetus from me and other line managers to get them to wake up and say, wait a minute, you're stopping work down here. And I understand you've got this, but you guys got to resolve this, because I'm not even involved in this, and yet you're killing my work progress down here. So that can go either way, but I think those are probably just extremes.
Yeah, in this particular part of the book, I think the chapter that I enjoyed the most was the managerial climate. I think McGregor was one of the first to focus on it, how the climate, the managerial climate, is created through daily interactions, and how important that is. You know, that it's in the micro movements of every day that sets that environment or that climate there, which the manager, I think it's another metaphor used in the book, irrigates the situation to bring the best out of the employee, basically. It's the subtle behavioral manifestations that alter the psychological climate as well. And I would imagine that these comments in that time again would have been quite extraordinary and would have captured people's imaginations as well. But it's something that's totally relevant still today. So whether you're theory X or your theory Y, you're still dealing with day-to-day the managerial climate, or even if you're a mixture of the two or none of the above, it still affects your day-to-day life at work. And one of the strengths of the book is its relevance and how important that is. So there's a lot of in mainstream literature and in the books that are available in all of the bookshops for people to give them guidance and how to be managers and how to work, and how it's in the subtleties of our relationships on a micro level, sometimes on a day-to-day basis as managers, that determine not only the happiness and the productivity of employees, but actually the performance of the organization.
Right, and McGregor gives several examples of that, where people will say they want one thing, but they behave in a different way. And what I really like about the way he addresses that is in just in place of saying, "Oh, that's a bad manager; they're just not doing the right thing," he attempts to deconstruct the principles and then tie that back to the principle of integration and saying, "Well, you're not going down this far enough down this direction, or you say you value integration, but here's some of the things you do that undermine it." And I think that is really one of the most important parts of the book, and the way McGregor writes is he takes that perhaps basic idea, but very powerful idea of the principle of integration, and then shows all the different aspects and through which it works. And Catherine, you're spot on by saying, and it's not all these necessarily grand, large things like how you set performance standards and what people are supposed to be doing and do performance appraisal. It's also in the small things you do. And I think that's probably one of the hardest things about managing with a theory Y perspective, or based on theory Y assumptions, is it's hard work to be consistent with all of those things.
And time consuming as well. You know, the pressures that organizations and businesses are under on a day-to-day basis. Even though I think most people nowadays would aspire to be more theory Y themselves as managers and perhaps as organizations as well. But there's also a certain level of skill involved in being able to adapt your managerial climate through how you interact with people that work for you, with you, and actually above you, to influence the organization. So it isn't the easiest route to choose. I'm not sure that comes across from the book.
Well, I think it does. It depends on how you look at it. He does talk about it being a balance. And in the latter part of the book where he talks about management development, he really is not very supportive of this idea that you can learn management in a classroom, that you actually have to do these things.
Yeah.
So I think that addresses some of this idea of complexity, that it's a very complex task that you're just kind of not going to learn from a book per se. And then he weaves in those parts about management and management development, this idea about mentorship. You know, he doesn't really use that word, but he's really talking about developing people and recognizing what it takes to develop them. And like you said, it's very cumbersome. You can't just use forms to do this development, although perhaps forms have a role to play to help people and maybe checklists and those kinds of things. So I think he gets at it indirectly.
Yeah.
But it would be a mistake to say, oh, yeah, this management stuff, I have a checklist where I can just follow these rules, because it's a lot of work involved.
I think as well in the annotated edition, there is the text from his lecture on leadership in 1954. And he does say, having had more experience, that the boss must boss. So theory Y is great, but very personally from his own experience, the boss must boss. I thought that was really interesting insight.
And that concludes part one of episode 59. Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoyed the discussion and found it valuable. If so, please tell your friends, colleagues, and students who may be interested in the podcast. You can also give us feedback, which we love to receive, via Twitter, Facebook, or through our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Please join us next time as we continue our discussion of McGregor's book, The Human Side of Enterprise, here on Talking About Organizations.